Hi, I'm James.
And I'm Anthony.
And this is Words and Numbers.
What's new and exciting in your world this weekend?
Listener PJ Blinn wrote us. His email begins, "Anthony, parenthetically, I assume James isn't reading. I came across an interesting situation of basic incentives in action on a recent trip to Germany. I attended a soccer game where, upon buying a beer, I was charged an extra €1 for a deposit, which really confused me. But then I realized that the deposit was for the cup. Instead of serving the beer in a single-use plastic cup, it was served in a reusable plastic cup that had the name of the team on it. Upon ordering another drink or returning the cup back to the stand, you get your €1 back, or it's reused for the next round. I saw people collecting cups to return to the stand for the €1 deposit. Some had stacks of them, as those careless enough to leave their cup lying around saw them swooped up by the cup grabbers.
Some people value their time at more than a euro, so they toss the cup.
So they toss it, right.
But enterprising people can go get 50 of them.
And it's just a beautiful story of incentives. We kind of do that, or at least we did, back when I was a kid in this country, when soda or pop used to come in glass bottles. There would be a deposit on the bottles, which gave you an incentive to bring them back. And if you're rich enough that you don't care, you're just going to toss it, well, someone else has incentive to go find them and bring them in for you.
In Connecticut, where I grew up, there was a nickel on every can. And what you found was people walking up and down the side of the road, picking them up, because back then people often threw things out their window.
Right.
Polluting was much more rampant then than now. You could actually make a pretty good hourly wage if you had the right streets.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I love to see examples like this of people seeing a problem and then rather than turning to government and saying, well, we need a law to do whatever, instead turn to the market and ask, how can I create an incentive for people to behave the way I want them to behave? We talk about unintended consequences with regard to government, but here there's no government involvement, but there is a potential unintended consequence of the €1 deposit on the cup. I did a little bit of digging and discovered that I could have cups made with the team logos for 50
yep.
cents a piece.
There you go.
So I got a 50 cent profit. I just have 1,000 of these things made, take them over to the stadium and get a euro each.
That kind of bumps up against a scheme I had as a young man. So when I was 18, and this was later stolen by Jerry Seinfeld, the deposit on cans and bottles where I was a nickel. But it said right on the label, Michigan, 10 cents. I thought all I need to do is fill up a big giant truck with these things and drive them over to Michigan. It turned out that that was a lot more difficult than I first thought. But isn't that interesting that I went straight to economics the minute I saw this? Maybe I should have been an economics student earlier.
You kind of have to be an economist or think like one to see stuff like this. But you don't have to be an economist to respond to incentives. People do it naturally. So it doesn't matter whether people understand the economics. You offer the €1 deposit and they're going to behave the way you want them to behave. They'll bring the cups back. And then you could extend the thought and say, well, why can't you do it for the other trash? And just say, you know, a euro per bag of trash wrapped up, you bring it on. No, because then what you're going to have is people from all the surrounding community bringing their home trash in for a euro a bag.
And not only that, they don't have to deal with their trash, which for Europeans,
yes.
I remember when I went to Italy, I had an apartment up on the fourth floor. As we walked in, there were about 15 garbage cans looping around in the lobby, each with some sort of instructions for their use. They were all for something different.
The recycling goes down to that gradation.
Yes. Almost everything that was in your trash belonged in one of those gigantic containers. And yet what happened, people would walk down with their trash, look at the signs, think, I'm not going to divide my trash into 15 groups. I'm just going to throw it right here. And before you know it, the entire lobby was covered in garbage. Garbage cans?
They're empty. The garbage bags are just laying around.
That worked as well as every other public thing in all of Italy. It's an entire country dedicated to the proposition that no matter what, we can't get things done here. The headline, billionaires emit a million times more greenhouse gases than the average person. This according to Oxfam.
A million times more. Yeah, I don't believe that.
There is no way that's true. And as I read through this terrible article, we finally find this. The billionaires included in the study have a collective $2.4 trillion stake in 183 companies, which averages out at 3 million metric tons of carbon dioxide emitted per billionaire per year.
Good Lord, they counted the emissions of the companies that they own.
You latched right onto it there.
Astounding. I thought where you were going to go, and this was bad enough, that they were counting the people that the billionaires employed in their house, you know, domestic workers or whatnot. And even that is too much of a stretch because those people will be emitting carbon anyway. They'd just be doing it somewhere else.
We don't have to actually offer good argument. All we have to offer is a bunch of nonsense.
I've been noticing this. You get statements like this that are complete nonsense. You throw it out there and people will grab it. People who are prone to believe this sort of thing anyway, and they'll start repeating it. And they just keep repeating it with no evidence. They just say, well, of course this is true.
I hate billionaires, therefore. Well, no, Punkin, that's not how it works. The headline has a colon at the end and then says Oxfam. So Oxfam pushed this nonsense out, which means I will never take them seriously again. You and I sit here week after week being reasonable and offering data that proves a point. And instead, people act like this.
And that does nobody a service because I'm sure that there's good data that supports Oxfam's various positions on other topics that now we're not going to listen to.
This is ridiculous. And how ridiculous is it? It's not the foolishness of the week.
That's how ridiculous.
How in the hell is that not the most ridiculous thing? Here's the headline. National Park Service warns people to stop licking toad that causes hallucinations.
I saw that headline and didn't read the article.
The U.S. Park Service telling people to quit licking toads. Why on earth?
Shouldn't that be like the FDA or something?
I don't know, but why is this not a decision best made by the toad licker himself? I mean,
is there some damage to the toad?
No.
That was my assumption without reading
the toad.
The
toad would be frightened for a minute, and you know, then you'd lick him and let him go, and then you would hallucinate like a lunatic.
Okay, so this really does belong to the FDA. The Forest Service has no business saying anything.
Well, see if you can keep up with me here for a minute. I don't think this belongs to anyone. I think the government might want to back out of toad licking. Yeah, you're going to giggle every time I say it, right? Because it's that ridiculous.
I'm thinking about this in the Streisand effect. My guess is there was one person somewhere who licked a toad and some forest ranger saw him, and now we get this article. And because of this article, coast to coast, there's going to be thousands of teenagers going out into the woods licking toads.
Right. They will go out into the woods with the stated purpose of finding those toads.
Which they wouldn't have done had the Forest Service just been quiet about the whole thing.
I know, but you know, even I want to say it, I'm going to go out and lick some toads now. And for me, it's way easier because they were all over my backyard just a month ago during birthing season.
They're amphibians. You're in a desert.
And yet here they are. They turn their heads up and they make this terrible sound. And I want to lick a toad. I want to lick all the toads.
Let us know how that works out, James.
I guess I would tell our listeners to send me toads, but I don't think you could get them to me without killing them in a box. And I wonder if the Postal Service would get agitated if I keep getting live toads in the mail.
Right, yeah.
They might get angry about that.
We should mention this is our 300th episode. We have not missed a week since we started.
Not even that week where we're all sick.
We managed to time our hospital stays so that we don't miss the episode. It's a good time to thank all of our listeners for supporting us and continuing to listen week after week, despite James.
Go off.
And here's to coming back for another 300 episodes. To get more Ant and James, buy a copy of our excellent book, Cooperation and Coercion. You can find the paper and electronic versions on Amazon and the audio version on Audible. If you'd like to support Words and Numbers, make your way over to patreon.com/wordsandnumbers, where you can contribute to our podcast-making habits. If you'd like to schedule us to come speak at your event, be it corporate or educational, or have James officiate at your wedding, send us an email at wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com. For one-stop shopping for all things James and Ant, visit our website, wordsandnumbers.org. Throughout this conversation, we'll use a couple of technical terms that may be unfamiliar to non-economists. The first is income quintile. Economists take all the households of the United States and divide them into five groups, which we call quintiles. The bottom income quintile is the 20% of households that have the lowest incomes. The top income quintile is the 20% of households that have the most income. The middle income quintile is the 20% of households in the middle. Often, when economists talk about income inequality, they will reference the average income within each of the five quintiles. Transfer payments are negative taxes. That is, instead of the government taking money from you as it does with a tax, it actively gives you money. Examples of transfer payments include the earned income tax credit, income assistance, and Social Security benefits. Senator Phil Graham joins us this week. Senator Graham served 6 years in the U.S. House of Representatives and 18 years in the U.S. Senate, where he was chairman of the Banking Committee. Senator Graham is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He was vice chairman of UBS Investment Bank and is now vice chairman of Lone Star Funds. He taught economics at Texas A&M University and has published numerous articles and books, most recently, The Myth of American Inequality, How Government Biases Policy Debate. Senator Graham, welcome to Words and Numbers.
I'm for both words and numbers, and I'm very happy to be on your program.
We're very happy to have you.
James and I separately read your book, and both of us independently came away with the idea of this is a perfect companion to our book, Cooperation and Coercion. And in fact, the main thrust of your book is something we didn't talk about in ours that I think deserves a lot of conversation, and that's the concept of income inequality. Can you tell us a little bit about this? We make such a big deal about income inequality in this country to the extent that everyone just accepts it. They don't even ask, is there such a thing? They just accept, A, there is, and B, it must be bad, and what can we do about it?
First of all, for about 30 years, economists have done studies of what people consume relative to their income and what assets they own, and they have found a very difficult time reconciling consumption and asset ownership with government measures of income. Recently, the problem has become so clear that government data conflicts. Let me just give you an example. Labor statistics every year puts out data on how much Americans consume by income quintile. The Census Bureau, separate government agency, puts out data on how much income the various quintiles have. In the last decade, the consumption level of the bottom quintile of income earners in America exceeds their income by a margin of 2 to 1. In other words, they're consuming twice as much as their income. The second quintile is consuming 11% more than its income, and the top quintile is consuming only half of its income, even though there's no evidence they're saving 50% of their income. Well, what gives? If you go back to 1947 and you look at how the census calculates income, the bottom line is today the Census Bureau counts only 1/3 of all transfer payments as income to the people who receive the transfer. For example, they don't deal with taxes at all. So if you get a refundable tax credit in a check from the Treasury, that's not counted as your income by the Census Bureau. Food stamps, where you get a debit card, you go to the grocery store and you buy groceries. The Treasury pays for it. They don't count that as income. Medicaid, where the government pays your medical bills, they don't count that as income. Housing subsidies, where the government pays your rent, they don't count that. The census does not count over 100 federal, state, and local transfer payments as income to the people who received it. They don't deduct tax payments from the income of the people who pay the taxes. before they calculate things like income inequality. Finally, the Census Bureau's measure of household income is a building block for most of our measures of our well-being, the poverty rate, income inequality. And so basically what we find is if you count all transfer payments as income to people that got the benefit, all taxes as income lost to people that paid the taxes, then the ratio of the income of the top 20% of American earners to the bottom is not 16.7 to 1, as the census says, but 4 to 1. 3% of Americans, not 12%, are poor by the government's definition of poverty. And even more stunning, The Economist magazine says it is universally acknowledged that income inequality is large and growing in the West. Bernie Sanders says obscene and unsustained income inequality is growing at the rate it's growing. And yet we show that when you count all transfer payments as income to people that got the transfer payments, and you take taxes away from the income of the people who paid the taxes, that income inequality is actually lower today than it was in 1947. So we're having a big debate about redoing the whole American economy to deal with growing income inequality when it's not growing. Let's get the facts straight, and then let's have a debate. You can argue that 4 to 1 is too much income inequality among the quintiles. But it's a different argument in arguing that it's 16.7 to 1. You can argue that 2.5% of people being poor is too many. I would argue it is too many given our society. But these are people, by and large, that have fallen through the cracks because of mental illness and drug addiction. Providing more money for food stamps and housing subsidies and refundable tax credits don't reach these people. We need a completely different program to reach them. And the money we're providing is going to people that hadn't been poor in quite some time.
4 to 1 is well within the contours of what Ben and Jerry did in their own company when they were avowed socialists.
Yeah, listen. If Bernie Sanders went to sleep and dreamed and woke up and saw the actual counting all transfer payments as income, he would believe that his dream had come true. We transfer more of our gross domestic product than any other country in the world except France, more than Germany, more than Italy, more than Britain. Again, I think maybe we could reach a consensus politically if we got the facts straight. But we've got one group of people debating based on one assessment of what they think the facts are. We've got another group of people debating based on the world as they see through their eyes. And obviously, we're not reaching any conclusion. So we need to get our facts straight.
Let me pick on Bernie Sanders just another minute or two. He makes a lot of hay about this sort of thing. And it's almost as if he's saying, who are you going to believe, me or your own lying eyes?
Yeah, I know.
I don't see a lot of dire poverty in the United States. I hear about it all the time, but I've gone to almost every state now and I've not seen it. Where is it that they're pointing to?
Well, it's a small number of people who, because of mental illness or drug addiction, are on the streets in Austin and San Francisco. I pointed this out in a Wall Street Journal article a month or so ago. We increase spending to deal with poverty, but we don't count the benefit to people that are poor, so the poverty rate doesn't change, and so we increase transfer payments again, and the poverty rate doesn't change again because we don't count it. That's part of the problem, and we're not getting to the real problem, which is the mental illness and the drug addiction that puts people on the streets living in tents. And no matter how much we increase rent subsidies or food stamps, they don't apply for those programs, so they don't get them. But the people that get those benefits have long ago stopped being poor. In 1967, when the funding for the war on poverty started to ramp up, we were spending $9,700 per household in the bottom quintile on transfer payments. They were getting $9,700 worth of transfer payments. Today, 50 years later, they're getting $45,400 worth of transfer payments. We have elevated the average household in the bottom quintile into the American middle class. In fact, one of the extraordinary findings of the book is that the bottom 60% of American earners today, when you adjust for household size, basically make the same income. And you can imagine the resentment that is created when you've got a man and his wife, they both work, they're struggling to pay college tuition for their children, struggling to make ends meet, and yet living on the same street, you got people that are not breaking a sweat. Obviously, that creates resentment. And it's not racism, it's justifiable resentment. If we're going to provide the level of funding that we're providing in transfer payments, there's no way that you're going to get people to work in large numbers other than a mandatory work requirement. When we started the war on poverty, 68% of all prime work-age persons in the bottom quintile worked. Today, it's down to 36%.
Good Lord.
If you pay people for not working and you pay them as much as they'd get working, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to drop out of the labor market. It's exactly what has happened.
I want to go back to your comments on the Census Bureau. I can see the benefit to calculating inequality figures prior to taxes and transfers to see what's happening with the market as is, and then calculating them after taxes and transfers to see the effect of the various policies we put in place to address inequality. But Census Bureau, from my experience, they're pretty smart and pretty reasonable people. Why aren't they reporting clearly the before and the after figures?
It goes back to 1947, when they were just beginning to calculate these figures. Most people did not get transfers in kind. Government payments were in cash or cash equivalent. There weren't many fringe benefits in the private sector. Very few people had their employer pay for the health benefits. And so census defined income as basically cash payments. It was a fairly reasonable approximation in 1947. But with the coming of fringe benefits, which are not counted by the census, we count them in our numbers, and we count capital gains, which are not counted in the census. That makes income inequality greater, not smaller. But then what is not counted by the census is 2/3 of all transfer payments. They count some that are paid in cash equivalent, but they don't count the ones where the government does a tax refund with a check. Even though it's cash equivalent, it's the result of a tax. And they don't count taxes. Well, how can you compare your income and my income and look at our living standard, which is what the comparison is about, without taking taxes into account? Taxes and transfers make up 40% of the American economy. They're not counting 40 cents out of every dollar of income in the American economy. That is not a rounding error. That is a mega distortion. Did they set out to do it on purpose to affect policy? We don't get into all that. I don't know. But the point is, on decisions that have been made at the Census Bureau as to whether to count something as income, the decisions pretty consistently from the beginning, except for cash, has been to not count them. All the data we use is from government. It's not that we're putting our numbers in instead of their numbers. We're starting with their number and then taking other numbers the Bureau of Labor Statistics calculates. Ultimately, they collected data on all this stuff and they reported it, but they never combined it. So when you read in the paper what the poverty rate was last quarter or last year, they're not counting 2/3 of transfer payments. When you read what happened to inequality, they're not counting 2/3 of transfer payments. They're not counting taxes. And those produce very dramatic changes. And then we look at a bunch of other things. What causes earned income inequality? What about the super rich? Do they pay their fair share? Who are these people? If we just simply took their money, could we have everything we want in government? And then we look at mobility. Do Americans have a chance to rise? How many actually do better than their parents? 93% of people born in poor families have more income than their parents. And then we look at the last 50 years, the malign period where we talk about the economy's not performed for everybody, et cetera, and basically we show that the economy's produced a cornucopia of goods and services. They've been widely distributed, and every group in America has benefited, some more than others. Asians have exceeded everybody else in terms of achievement because they've gotten education, they work hard, large numbers are employed. People want to talk about income inequality as a measure of America's fairness, but America never promised income equality. America promised, in Abraham Lincoln's words, a fair chance and an open way to use your industry and intellect. An equality of outcome in the competition for life is alien to the American ethos. We just promise you get a chance. Obviously, you'd rather be born beautiful, brilliant, and rich. But people that are none of those things succeed in America every day.
You raise the question of mobility. This is something that James and I frequently talk about, that when people talk about the poor or the 1%, they talk as if these are static groups. And of course, they're not. James likes to say, it's absolutely correct, over the past several years, he's been in all five of the quintiles. What do you see when you look at the data? Is income mobility increasing, decreasing over time? Is it about the same as it was before?
Hard to tell, but let me tell you what we do know. 93% of children that grew up in the bottom quintile of income earners ended up living as adults in households that had more income than their parents, 93%.
That's, of course, adjusted for inflation and household size and all of that.
Adjusted for inflation. And then the question is, how many actually moved up in terms of a quintile of income? We find that in the middle three quintiles, that there's tremendous mobility. It's almost random what quintile you were born in and what quintile you end up in as an adult. And the top and the bottom quintile is where critics focus. Well, in the bottom quintile, 62% of children end up not only having more income than their parents, but actually moving up to a higher income quintile, including 6.1% that go all the way to the top. When you look at the 37% that don't move up, a substantial number of them are people who dropped out of the labor market in the last 50 years. As welfare payments spiraled, the labor force participation rate among the bottom quintile fell from 68% to 36%. Those people who dropped out of the labor force benefited from an increase in welfare expenditures, but their ability to rise further was thwarted by the fact that they didn't stay in the economy.
Right.
And then there's another thing. When we're measuring mobility, we measure the income brackets, not what they were for the parents, but what they are for the children. So that, for example, to get out of the bottom quintile, because of the incredible progress in America in the last 50 years, you had to have, in real terms, an income 85% more than your parents to rise out of the top quintile. Just to not fall, if you're in one of the other quintiles, you've got to have your income rise by a similar amount, or else you fall into a lower quintile. If we compared mobility to the definition of the quintiles for the parents instead of the children, income mobility would be astronomical.
Yeah, in other words, the brackets are themselves moving up over time.
Exactly.
If you held them constant, it looks like everybody's shooting up.
In fact, if you worked, there's no way practically that you would have stayed in the bottom quintile.
You see that at a gut level if you just look around. When I was a kid, households had one car. Once in a while, they'd have two, but commonly it was one. Today, it's uncommon to have one car. A lot of them have three, and the cars themselves are like spaceships compared to cars of the 1960s. And
oh, of course.
The same thing with refrigerators and HVAC and on and on and on. So when you actually look at the things people consume, clearly we're way better off.
In 1965, about half the bottom quintile households in America did not have complete indoor plumbing. 50 years later, there's virtually no place that doesn't have indoor plumbing. Most places are air conditioned. How many people had air conditioning 50 years ago? Almost nobody.
Right.
The smallest Ford you can buy is more reliable than a Rolls Royce was in 1965. Look at the appliances people have, color television, flat screens. Most bottom quintile families have a computer. 45% of bottom quintile households own their own home.
45%. That's astounding.
People forget what the world was like. I remember when I was growing up, we would ride past Dr. Dykes's house. He was a doctor in town, was well off. My mother would stop our 1940 Plymouth and point out the window and say, "You work hard, you can have a house like that." Dr. Dykes's house today would be an ordinary upper middle income American home. We tend to forget what the world was like, and we don't give America the credit it deserves, in my opinion. And, you know, you look at cars on the road. How many clinkers do you see? When I was growing up, there were junkers everywhere on the road.
Right.
Now, you almost never see an old car on the road, partly because the models don't change that much over time, but partly because people are a lot better off. The average bottom quintile home owns more than one car.
We point out all the time that the poor in America probably live better than Louis XIV did, what with indoor plumbing and medicine and things like this. And people bristle at this. They don't want to hear it.
No.
And all we say is, okay, would you trade places with him if you could? And then they would say, well, no, not really. But everybody else would.
For a day or two. No, look, we live in a golden age and in the greatest country in the history of the world. And we don't give enough credit. We're not thankful enough, in my opinion.
Senator Graham, you served in both the House and the Senate as both a Republican and a Democrat. I think you're uniquely qualified to answer. You might be the only person who could answer my next question with experience instead of just raw opinion. Do you see any hope with anybody in the two parties in terms of dealing with the federal debt, which is, if it's not crippling already, it's going to be quite crippling pretty soon?
Well, I think it is a big problem that is awfully easy to put off. I wrote Graham Leach Bliley to try to force government to face up to the debt, and it had an effect for about a decade, and Congress then figured out how to cheat on it, and then President Clinton waived it when he had the opportunity to. The debt is a real problem, and look, it's going to come back and bite us. Interest rates have been almost zero. And they're rising very rapidly now. The mortgage rate is over 7%.
Just a few months ago, I refinanced at 2.8.
Yeah, I know. Well, when you start paying interest on government debt and the bonds are paying 6%, it's going to just kick a huge hole in the federal budget. If you got to pay 6% and the economy's growing at 3%, it gets difficult. Right now, we have very big political differences. The founders never intended elections to mean as much as they do. I think part of our differences are the sort of way we treat each other and talk to each other. But part of them is that what we want for America is so fundamentally different. And one of the things I hope this book does is get everybody to agree on one set of facts. And then sit down and see how far apart are we? If Bernie Sanders knew how much money we're already transferring to low-income people, I think it is bound to have some effect. If you ask him today, what would you be satisfied if we could make the transfer this larger percentage of the economy? What would satisfy you? What would you think would be an amount you would be happy with? My guess is the amount he would pick is not far from what we're actually transferring.
Might actually be lower.
Might actually be lower. That's exactly right.
It's funny you say that. I, for a decade now, have experimented with my students. I show them the average income for the various quintiles, and I say, tell me, what do you think is a fair tax rate for these three groups after deductions, exemptions, all of that? And so I let them debate it a while, and of course, they come up with different numbers, but generally speaking, the numbers they come up with are what we're currently taxing. It's not counting the transfers you were talking about, which pushes it even further.
Yeah.
But we talk a lot about fairness without asking what's fair.
To some people, fair, they're going to keep changing the definition, but most people are pretty reasonable. I think that the biggest problem with the level of transfer payments now is that it's gotten so large that we fundamentally affected people's behavior. When Lyndon Johnson announced a war on poverty, his goal was to make it possible for people to advance themselves, to develop their own skills. Well, what the war on poverty has done is exactly the opposite. We have eliminated, for all but a very small group of people that have unique problems, abject poverty. But the price that has been paid in doing it is that we've got people who are idle. And so the question is, how happy are people who don't work? I don't think I'd be happy sitting on my front porch. I have a good wife, and I don't want her to get bored with me and throw me out. So I keep working.
Most people aren't going to know that you're a trained economist.
No, that's right.
How did that work for you when you got into public life and everybody just assumes away whatever they want to assume away without recurrence to the data whatsoever? You must have had a 30-year stomachache.
It helped me immensely because I had dealt with economic issues, and most of what government deals with are economic issues. But it also put a burden on me in that I knew some things were important that some of my colleagues didn't understand was important. And so I ended up in a lot of fights that most members were just willing to let slide. Trade was one of the issues. I understood trade and how damaging protectionism is. And it constantly got me into battles. I had been in the Senate for 2 months when somebody proposed an oil import fee. I led the effort against it, and I killed it. And so for about 6 months, I was the third senator from Massachusetts because I represent Texas. We produce oil. But what you understand is we consume more than we produced then. And there were more jobs in processing than there were in production. And an import fee would have rendered this vast crescent of petrochemical industries from Beaumont to Corpus Christi non-competitive on the world market. And so I had to go all over the state, DuPont plants and whatever, explaining it to people. But once I explained it, people understood it. I have been very lucky. I've had three good careers. I was in academics. I loved it. I loved my students. And then I was in government, and I've enjoyed all of them. I'm a very fortunate person. No doubt about that.
Thousands listen every week. What would you like to tell them that they might not be hearing in their regular lives?
America is a better country than our government data shows. Income inequality is about one-fourth what the data shows. Poverty is closer to 3% than it is to 12%. Income inequality has not risen in the last 70 years. It is not a crisis. It is not obscene. It is not unsustainable. Mobility is alive and well in America. There are rich people. Bill Gates is rich. But are you poor because Bill Gates is rich? I would say you're richer because Bill Gates is rich. He created products that have enriched our lives. He owns 7% of Microsoft. It's a lot of money. But who owns the other 93%? Basically, our pension funds. So we've all benefited. I don't understand this envy of people who succeeded. They succeeded by doing something that made us better off. And this idea that you got these mega rich people, and if we could just take more of their money, we could just have everything. Well, let me tell you, if you took all the mega rich that Bernie Sanders is talking about, he and Senator Warren no longer talk about millionaires because everybody's figured out they're millionaires. Okay? So now it's billionaires. Well, if you took all the income of all the billionaires that the government doesn't already take, you couldn't fund government for a week. There are not enough rich to fund our government. The government taxes middle and upper middle income Americans for the same reason Willie Sutton robs banks. Because that's where the money is.
That's right.
And so don't get it in your head that there are all these rich people out there and we could take their money and, my God, we could just have everything. It's not so. And if we are going to expand government, you're going to end up paying for it. American mobility works. If you work, America works for you.
You've just given young people the exact same advice your mother gave you when she pointed to the big house.
Oh, that's right.
Senator, thank you for being on Words and Numbers. And your book,
thank you.
The Myth of American Inequality, How Government Biases Policy Debate. We'll have a link in the show notes, and we encourage our listeners to have a look.
Please do. If it's not in the bookstore, you can buy it on Amazon. Don't be put off by tables and charts. It's easy to read. You just got to be able to add and subtract.
It is very readable.
Thank you, guys. I really enjoy it.
Thank you.
That's all the time we've got this week on Words and Numbers. Until next time, be sure to follow us on Twitter. Handles are in the show notes. Join Words and Numbers Backstage, the Facebook group where the conversation continues. And
send us email, wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
Until next week, try to be nice to one person. One person who doesn't deserve it. Just one. And who knows? It may turn into a trend. Give it a shot. You might feel good about yourself.
You could say you tried.
You tried. That's right. Till next week, can't take it easy.
See you next week, James.